9. Writing a poem now. Philosophies of composition. No one knows what contemporariness is. In other words, they don't know where they are going, but they are on their way. Gertrude Stein. Quote, interview with Rosemary Waldrop. The Mighty Dead. Some things never change for a poet of serious intent. There is an empty space on the page, the screen, or in the ear, and the poet wants to fill it with something new, not to repeat the past. This can be experienced as a nearly debilitating pressure, as Coleridge, writing of himself in the third person in his notebook, shows. He rose, drew his writing desk suddenly before him, sat down, and took the pen, and found that he knew not what to do. Quote R. Holmes, Coleridge, Early Visions, 1989, page 283. The painter, Benjamin Haydon, writing to John Keats at the time he was writing Keats's Endymion, thinks over his own day's labours, on what I had done, and with a burning glow on what I would do, till filled with fury, I have seen the faces of the mighty dead crowd in my room, and I have sunk down and prayed the Great Spirit that I might be worthy to accompany these immortal beings in their immortal glories. And then I have seen each smile as it passed over me, and each shake their heads in awful encouragement. The Letters of John Keats, Volume 1, 1958, Editor H. E. Rollins, page 124. Artists of all kinds know Haydon's paradoxical experience. The mighty dead, a phrase Keats had used in Endymion, intimidates because we feel we can never emulate their achievement. But at the same time, their awful encouragement offers a daunting yet tantalizing model of what we would like to reach in our way. At other times, the artist might feel filled with hope and find, like Keats, that the air that floated by me seemed to say, "Write, thou wilt never have a better day." This chapter will explore how practicing poets in the present time seek to work through their good days and bad days. As Gertrude Stein suggests, it is not always possible to gain a perspective to tell the writer if she or he is doing anything new of her own time. The past 100 years have seen an unprecedented and swift development in all recording media, from the typewriter to multimedia and the internet. How do these affect poets who have grown up with them and write in this context? Hearing voices. If I knew where poems came from, I'd go there, remarks Michael Longley, 1939 to date. As we have seen in the section on inspiration in the previous chapter, the idea that poems have a mysterious source outside the purview of the mind's conscious processes is very powerful, and it certainly persists into the present day. Many poets, for instance, cite periods of silence, the famous block, when sometimes for years she or he feels no impulse or possible beginning of a poem enter their mind. Equally, they might experience an unaccountable torrent of creativity. Geoffrey Hill, for instance, published his first collection in 1959, and then only infrequently for almost 40 years, until between 1996 and 2014, he more than doubled the corpus of his life's work. These periods are as unpredictable as the sudden movements that can incite individual poems. Fleur Adcock, 1934 to date, speaks eloquently of this experience. "What seems to happen is this. A phrase arrives in my head, usually when I am in a relaxed, dreamy state, times when the barriers between the conscious and the unconscious mind are at their most permeable. This given phrase contains, as it were, the genetic fingerprint of what is to follow. The rhythm of the phrase indicates the rhythm, and to some extent the tone, shape, texture, and even the length of the finished poem. These qualities are all wrapped up in those few initial words, as the embryo of a plant is wrapped up in a seed. And it is my job to nurture and encourage the seed until it expands into its final form. Editor C.B. McCulley, The Poet's Voice and Craft, 1994, page 148. With the addition of the metaphor from genetics, Adcock's account is cast in the romantic tradition of organic composition we saw described by Emerson, Coleridge, and other romantic writers. That is, that the beginnings of composition come unbidden and have a natural shape, likened here to the growth of a seed. "Nice work, if you can get it," might be the response to Adcock's description by a skeptic, who always suspected poets of layabout tendencies. How can this reverie-born inception relate to the craft and graft of poetic form? For Adcock, who writes mainly within formal structures, the form finds itself, and then it is for her to work consciously and skillfully to complete it. But still, the concept of the form finding itself, the process by which something, historically shaped, prior to and quite outside of the mind of an individual poet, can be sensed as intrinsic to the mind of that poet, is hard to grasp, and certainly to explain. In a 2009 interview with Anna Smail for the Wolf magazine, the American poet Frank Bidart, 1939 to date, addresses this question from his own experience. In recent collections, Bidart has moved to more formal structures in his poems, especially the use of stanzas. But in his own accounts of composition, he has frequently described hearing his poems as almost dictated by what he calls a voice. His interviewer wants to know if Bidart is still hearing the voice before it falls into the form. Bidart replies, "Oh, very much. On the other hand, things become possible for the voice if you have the right form, if you have the right, well, if you can find the right stanza or the right shape for the voice on the page. But I definitely still hear a voice. Sometimes I can't get the voice quite right. I mean, sometimes I feel this passage in the poem has to be a certain length, and sometimes I don't know that right away. But as I write and rewrite, it will become clear, say, this has got to be 9 lines, or something like that. And I still can't get the movement right within those lines, and I have to work very, very hard." The Wolf, issue 22, 2009, page 39. It seems that for Bidart, his voice is primary. But whilst in one sense it seems to speak the poem, it does not do so in a way that the poet can immediately catch what it says. Yet more paradoxically, Bidart's later experience is that his use of a shape like the stanza enables him eventually to hear those exact words. Now Bidart changes his terminology to refer to the pulse of the poem. "I think a good poem has a pulse of its own. It's not just a question of meter. Finding the right stanzaic form helps one fix the pulse of the poem on the page." Pulse is very like Fleur Adcock's explanation of how that phrase that arrives in my head has a certain rhythm, and that it was rhythm that first seduced me into liking poetry in the beginning in nursery rhymes, hymns, poetry her mother read to her as a child, and later poets. Now she writes, "I'm always conscious of the rhythm without being in control of it." And like Bidart, she has the sense of dictation. It is not necessary to become too metaphysical to understand these poets' experience. What these and many other poets are seeking to express is the importance of rhythm for verse. As we have seen in previous chapters, particularly chapter 4, the verse line, rhythm is the hardest quality to define, whether it is embodied in measure or in free verse. But the convergence of the words that are semantically right with the most intuitive sense of the poem's pulse, or voice, like a body fusing with its shadow, is what the working poet in most aspects of the genre seeks. There are poets who would dispute this formulation, and we shall come onto other ideas later. As Duke Ellington said of jazz, "It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing." Under pressure. While we acknowledge the validity and importance of the intuitive element in composition, it is equally important to recognize and understand the role of conscious deliberation, the kind of effort that Fleur Adcock says feels comfortingly like work. As we have seen, the greatest change to poetry in the 20th century was the development of free verse, and the freedom from a canon of traditional forms continues to be enjoyed and to be radically extended in our own day. Nonetheless, traditional forms, remade for contemporary needs and speech, are still very widely used, and, as we shall see, new stipulations are invented. The reasons for this are several. The unprecedented nature of free forms can induce a kind of anxiety in the artist. Fleur Adcock again expresses this cogently when she says that while she thinks free verse the purest type of verse, in that its rhythms are entirely innate and inherent, it has no rules by which to adjust them. It is difficult to write, because you can never be reassured by external considerations that you've got it right. Exactly the same uncertainty is found in other kinds of artists. The painter, Henri Matisse, 1869-1954, observed that to give yourself completely to what you're doing while simultaneously watching yourself do it, that's the hardest of all for those who do work by instinct. Brad Meldow, 1970, the jazz pianist, has said in an interview that improvisation offers incredible freedom, but also great responsibility, because there is so much room for bullshit and nonsense. You really have to figure out what your identity is in all that lack of form. In the absence of external norms, referred to composition must be accompanied by an improvising and ceaseless self-criticism. All of us who have presented to other minds a piece of writing we knew to be both lucid and peerless, only to witness their utter incomprehension, know the penalties of myopic self-critique. This last experience points towards another possible reason for the continuance of form in contemporary writing. Over the last generation, across the English-speaking world, creative writing has become a part of the education curriculum, especially the most influential in universities. Curricula require perceived rigour and a historical dimension, and in poetry, the study and practice of traditional forms can supply demonstrable discipline. Technical skill and concentration are necessary to write verse, and being set to write sonnets and sestinas is frequently seen as a way to inculcate these qualities in student or apprentice poets. The virtues of this in any respect whatsoever are, of course, disputed, and any influence impossible to measure. But the institutionalization of poetry composition is bound to have an effect on the art at large. I shall discuss some of the others later. And it is certainly possible that a renewed interest in set forms is among them. Certainly several magazine editors have remarked upon the increased technical accomplishment of submissions they receive. Nonetheless, over and above the arguments advanced, the poet accepts prior stipulations, whether they be traditional forms or newly invented ones, for one overwhelming reason. This is the one I quoted John Crow Ransom sustaining at the end of chapter 2, that the restriction forces the poet's mind below the surface of their readiest expression. It exerts a pressure towards new words, and indeed new mental states. The antithesis of the dictum, first thought, best thought, an imposed restriction, frees the verbal mind to go beyond its most superficial expressions and consciousness. I shall now try to explore its operations in a few very different instances. Taking exercise, in his description of the composition of his early poem, The Thought Fox, Ted Hughes, 1930-98, tells how the idea came to him unexpectedly late, one snowy night in dreary lodgings in London, after a year not writing, and how the poem was then written in a few minutes. Hughes' account lends further credence to the part inspiration plays in composition, notwithstanding that the poem itself deploys rhyme and half-rhyme, and has a double subject in being about both the realization of a physical fox and the process of composition. The image of the fox's footprints in the snow is also that of the print on the page. But equally, Hughes has written very instructively about the process and virtues of set exercises to encourage and develop writing both in verse and prose. In his influential book, Poetry in the Making, written mainly for school students and their teachers, but readily transferable to older writers, he proposes a series of set tasks, employing given themes or objects. Crucially, these begin with a strictly time-controlled session, often of no more than 10 minutes. These artificial limits create a crisis which rouses the brain's resources. The compulsion towards haste overthrows the ordinary precautions, flings everything into top gear, and many things that are usually hidden find themselves rushed into the open. Barriers break down, prisoners come out of their cells. Ted Hughes, Poetry in the Making, 1967, page 23. The results may not always be so dramatically revelatory, but such exercises do exert a pressure that unceremoniously demystifies the candlelit preciousness of the poet at work. Such class exercises have become a staple method in many creative writing classes, with the aim of loosening inhibitions around the writing process, and sometimes, hopefully, the imagination itself. These need not centre upon topics or themes, but are often more technical. For instance, imposing a small and very strict word limit, say 49 words, not 48 or 50. Or forbidding words containing a particular vowel. These repetitions have the salutary effect of forcing the writers to look at the particularities of words, how much essential work a word is doing, and what other words might be reachable. Again, it is a means to escape the superficial and discard the cliché. These exercises are of a piece with the long-standing tradition among poets of testing themselves by taking on the challenge of writing in different forms. Couplets, sonnets, sestinas, limericks, or whatever. Sometimes this might be quietly or noisily competitive. In the 16th century, Scottish poets challenged one another to flightings, a competition in which each would improvise poetical abuse towards his opponent, until one retired, tongue-tied, or listeners declared a winner. There are similar jousts in the sexual wars in Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, between Catherine and Petruchio, and in Much Ado About Nothing, between Beatrice and Benedict. In our own time, though hopefully without the abuse, Poetry Slams maintains the competitive element, described in the section on performance poetry in Chapter 2, have a similar competitive element. In such an arena, the most prominent features of poetic form, strong metre, often trochaic, alliteration, and full rhyme, will most readily impress an audience, and the manifest skill with which the poet can deploy them will be at a premium. In the previous edition of this book, to illustrate the process of working with an existing form in a contemporary setting, I included a discussion of a poem written in terza rima by a contemporary poet, Vona Groke, 1964 to date. I asked her to describe something of the same process in her work 15 years later, and she responded by giving an account of the very different book-length poem, Link, Poet and World, that she published in 2021. Here is her account of the poem. By the time you've established 7 poetry collections, I think it's inevitable that your thoughts would turn to the question of how to make the 8th a little different. I never wanted to be the equivalent of the artist who paints stripes for 40 years, only in different colours. Doesn't he ever want to try a circle for a change? Or even, heaven help us, a triangle? Round about that time, I was also doing a year-long course in Salford, in hand-making books, thinking about the relationship between form and content in the context of the book, in addition to the usual question of how to align these two within a poem. I wanted to try writing a book-length collection of linked poems. Once that decision was made, 3 other possible structural possibilities presented themselves. The idea of having 2 characters in dialogue with each other throughout the book, world and poet. The idea of assigning prose to world and, more obviously, poetry to poet. And the idea of an alphabetic spine to the book, so each of the 26 poems and answering prose pieces kicks off with the same letter. Link, Poet and World became, I have to admit, that most dreadful of creatures, a lockdown project. Because of life circumstances, I was thinking about the strangeness of being a poet. How this thing that we do in privacy, and usually solitude, makes its way out into the world beyond us, if we're lucky, to be received, or not, by a world that is programmed to adopt a resistant or sceptical response to it, for the most part. It's a quizzical, highly pressurized and often fraught relationship, really, between the poems, written out of interiority, and the context in which they then have to make their way, or not. The various lockdowns exaggerated that teasing two-step of private and public, and I wanted to examine this in language, and also hold it to account. The character of poet is some way close to the lyric voice I've used in my previous books, if a little more earnestly self-conscious. Against it, however, world, which is also my voice, of course, if refracted a little, plays engagement off against arrogance, diffidence, or repulsion, constantly toying with poet, or putting her in her place. I'm fairly certain the poems win. Whenever I read from the collection, I find it's the poems I want to focus on. Perhaps that's because they're more complete in themselves, more composed and self-sustaining, as poems tend to be. Or perhaps it's because world tends to be more pinched, garrulous, and egotistic. His voice firmer and less supple, and therefore less interesting to me. The surprises, the interesting turns of phrase, mostly fall to poet, on purpose. And the most inventive thinking too, with its problem-solving ways. Because there ought to be somewhere this can happen, right? Where world doesn't always squish poet, where poetry wins the day. And here is the poem from the sequence. Daily News Roundup. For another trick, or the same trick, played out differently. I will convert rain to protest, and protest to everything making rain. Into the bargain, a kind of everything. For this I will need the sound of people, and the cause, a reason to be furious and right. A start point and an end point, that is nothing of the sort. And a street or a park, somewhere with cameras and camera phones. So the march will be picked up and broadcast, spreading from the west or from the east, depending on which way the wind is blowing, and where you stand this day. Then it's a question of sound effects, of turning the volume up or down, up to lose yourself in the noise, down to hear yourself think. As if you lived under galvanized, and the rain has news to shake you up, and how it hits the surface hard, so hard you think the roof will cave in, but it doesn't. You're still safe and sound, except back there for a second only, when you thought it fell into your name. Detachment. There's a thing. You could live in a cottage in the crook of a mountain, on the outskirts of a ghost town, and still he would come calling, world, and ask for the kind of herbal tea nobody sells round these parts. There he is, in the chair nearest the fire, as if he owned the place. And there you are, glowering, fit to be tied, your right hand spooning the wrong tea into a chipped pot.
Won't you join me? Says the world. Says world.
And you would, except there's one chair only, and one cup to drink from. Groke begins by expressing the familiar idea of wanting to do something different in her new book. She also invokes her perception of the poem as something fashioned, a deliberately made thing, through the reference to the bookmaking course that she was simultaneously pursuing. Formally, too, she's putting poetry and prose alongside each other, in the two voices of poet and world. There is therefore not only a dialogue between these two voices, but between these two modes of writing, and how far they might represent private and public. The formal structure of the poem is not as familiar as a rhyme scheme such as Terza Rima, but the pressure of form is certainly evident, a pressure that is felt across the whole book. Translation. Translation has always been part of the Western, and doubtless other, poetic traditions. Contemporary poets are often stimulated by foreign language poets and poems whom they encounter either in the original or in translation. The custom of writing a poem after or in imitation of a preceding foreign work is commonplace. But for some poets today, the model of a particular foreign language poet, or deep engagement with a second language, is crucial to the way they work, and how their writing has developed. Elaine Feinstein, 1930-2019, is renowned as the foremost translator of the Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva, 1892-1941. Through this work, she says, Tsvetaeva became the most important single influence on my own work. In a sense, it seems she was ready for this particular influence, since as a young poet seeking her way in the 1950s, she did not feel comfortable in any of the English poetic tendencies of her day. Neither the movement poets associated with Philip Larkin, 1922-85, nor the English intelligentsia poets around Jeremy Prynne, 1936, whose poetics she admired, but whose passion for geography and English local history felt alien. Whilst sensing a connection through her own family's East European roots, Feinstein acknowledges that her own life bears no comparison with Tsvetaeva's life of poverty and exile as a poet, and mother in the desperate turbulence of revolutionary and post-revolutionary Russia, culminating in her lonely suicide. Yet she felt an affinity, albeit a dangerous one. More precisely, it was the effect of translating Tsvetaeva's verse that affected her own. Technically, she taught me how intensity of passion creates a strong rhythm that will flow down a page even when held in stanzas. After working on my versions of her poems, I began to see poetry as a matter of the spoken voice pushing against the shape of the verses on the page. After that, I rarely used completely open forms. E. Feinstein, Strong Words. Editors W. N. Herbert and M. Hollis, 2000, pages 188-89. Critics often write simplistically about poets finding their own voice, as though it is some latent, authentic gemstone deep in the writer's individual being. Elaine Feinstein's testimony shows how complex this quest can be, and how subject to external influences, even one from an utterly different language. The transactions between languages have been very much part of the formation of Gwyneth Lewis, 1959 to date, as a poet. Brought up as a Welsh speaker, she learned English as a necessary survival mechanism in the modern world. The pressures upon a minority language such as Welsh means, says Lewis, that to speak it is to know the sound of a long, unbearable farewell. To know Welsh, however, is to have access to another venerable literary tradition and to its forms. Cynghanedd is one of the complex poetic forms required in the verse competitions of the Welsh Eisteddfodau, or cultural festivals of Welsh-speaking Wales. As Lewis points out, Cynghanedd was used in English by Gerard Manley Hopkins, 1844-89, and influenced the style of Dylan Thomas, 1914-53. Another poet conscious of his Welsh antecedents, Wilfred Owen, 1893-1918, makes notable use of half-rhyme or pararhyme in his war poem Strange Meeting, Escaped, Scooped, Groined, Groaned, Bestirred, Stirred. And in doing so, he drew upon the use of this technique in the medieval Welsh version of the style known as proest. For John Silkin, 1930-97, in A World of Disharmony and Moral Uncertainty, the discord of pararhyme is a truer equivalent to the cataclysmic experience of Owen and his contemporaries than full rhyme. This kind of exchange between the languages continues to be an important part of Gwyneth Lewis's poetics. Indeed, she publishes poetry in both languages. Being bilingual, she has a better claim than most poets who dabble in translation to recognize its nature and importance, and she challenges some common assumptions about its practice. I am one of those who believes that not only is tradition possible, it is an essential element in every nation's culture. Poetry isn't only what's lost in translation, it's what's gained. In a culture, the desire to translate is always a sign of strength. Only rich cultures are hungry for news of the outside world. Paradoxically, veracity is a sign of plentitude. Here, I take it that the whole point of translation is to introduce a new element of rhythm or thought into a literary tradition. The point isn't to produce a version so culturally smooth that no one would ever guess it was imported. There has to be something strange, novel, and fascinating either about the style or cast of mind of the new piece. Gwyneth Lewis, Strong Words, editors W. N. Herbert and M. Hollis, 2000, pages 266-7. Lewis's final point is especially important for English language poets. The hegemony of English as a world language makes the temptation for everything to sound English in translation very powerful. But such a process of absorption can efface the distinct identity of a poem, or other literary work, as it is in its own language. It is truer to the original to retain words and phrasings that give a sense of it even at the cost of an initial roughness in English. The otherness of the foreign language needs to be retained. At the present time, the number of poets working in the Anglophone world whose first language is not English will be increasing as the metropolitan centres of Britain, Ireland and the United States have more and more citizens from language backgrounds in, say, South Asia and Latin America. More and more writing poetry now will involve, as for a poet like Gwyneth Lewis, translation and writing across and between these language groups. What are words? In a poetry reading in Zurich, on 14th of July, 1916, Hugo Ball, 1886 to 1927, was carried to the stage. He was wearing a costume which meant he could not walk, and began to read from his work. Gajiberi, Bimba, Glandridi, Laula, Loni, Kadori, Gajama Grama, Berida, Bimbala, Gladri, Galasasa, Lodita Lomini, Gaji, Beri Bin Blasa, Glasala, Lola, Loni, Gadorsu. Before long, the audience exploded, some with delight, some with outrage. This, the first of Baal's abstract phonic poems, was not only a challenge to the nature of poetry as serious, significant speech, a criticism of life, as Matthew Arnold, 1822-88, had grandly called it, but jettisoned familiar language, and with it any semantic intention, that is, any attempt to make sense in a poem. Why did Baal do this? The Dada, anti-art movement of which Baal was a founder in the early years of the World War of 1914-18, held the European society that had engendered such slaughter in contempt. For the Dadaists, all its conventions, institutions, and utterances were a pretentious and delusory sham. Against the sense it propounded, they posed nonsense. Against order, anarchy. For Ball, who was a journalist, official discourse had been corrupted, and so, in these phonic poems, we want to abandon a language ravaged and laid barren by journalism. We must return to the deepest alchemy of the word, and leave even that behind us, in order to keep safe for poetry its holiest sanctuary. Hans Richter, Dada, Art and Ant-Art, 1965, page 42. So, Baal's abstract phonetic poems are intended to have a provocative social and indeed political effect. As we can tell from his terminology, for him the project had a religious dimension, and not long after the exuberant evening in Zurich, Baal turned away from Dada to live a religious life of poverty among the peasants of rural Switzerland. "I have examined myself carefully," he wrote, "and I could never bid chaos welcome." Page 43. But the ideas and impulses of Baal and the other Dadaist poets can be seen as the wellspring of much radical poetic practice throughout the 20th century and up to the present day. It gives rise to a progressive series of questions. What is poetry? What are words? What is language? Is meaning possible? And what is meaning? In my preface to this book, I wrote of the perpetual paradox of poetry, of the attraction of two poles, one towards the desire to say something that is meaningful and memorable, and the other towards a desire to say nothing, but to rejoice in the peculiar nature of words themselves, their associations, their sounds, their visual shapes. or perhaps to invent new words. It is in considering poetry descended from Dada that we feel the pull of these two poles most powerfully. How to say nothing. The first way a poet might deny semantic expectations is to disrupt syntax. This is what E.E. Cummings, 1894-1962, does here. Anyone lived in a pretty how town, with up so floating many bells down, spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't a dance his did. Here, Cummings, part of his refusal of linguistic convention, was to eschew capital letters, begins by taking a conventional sentence, one that might be, for instance, John lived in a pretty New England town, and by substituting wrong parts of speech, jolts us out of our easy expectations. Cummings does this in this poem to a wider purpose, but some poets see their task, as Stefan Morosky puts it, to liberate the world from syntax and to create texts where the principal coherence is sound rather than syntax or semantics. We have already looked at some practice of this kind towards the end of chapter 2, Deliberate Space, and seen that this escape from semantics might focus on visual shapes, as in concrete poetry. But given that the whole of our education in language from infancy has been directed towards organizing sounds into words and words into syntactic chains that will enable us to share communication. If the chains are to be broken, perhaps we cannot rely on the internal processes of our minds, determined as they might be by the formulae and conventions of everyday discourse. That is by cliché. It is to enable this that writers have sought to derive impetus and material from a plethora of existing texts, not necessarily literary ones. The American poet, Charles Bernstein, 1950 to date, is one of the founders of LANGUAGE, poetry, mentioned in Chapter 2. We also encountered his colleague, Robert Grenier, towards the end of Chapter 5, Free Verse, with his question, where are the words most themselves? And his description of poetry as words occurring. Bernstein proposes 97 exercises, each of which will help words occur, and by minimizing the contribution of the conscious, composing mind, perhaps allow them to be most themselves. Here are a few suggestions from his list. Homophonic translation. Take a poem in a foreign language that you can pronounce, but not necessarily understand, and translate the sound of the poem into English, e.g. French blanc to blank, or tout to tout. Tzara's hat. Everyone in a group writes down a word, alternative, phrase, line, and puts it in a hat. Poem is made according to the order in which it is randomly pulled from hat. Solo, pick a series of words or lines from books, newspapers, magazines to put in the hat. Alphabet poems. Make up a poem of 26 words, so that each word begins with the next letter of the alphabet. Write another alphabet poem, but scramble the letter order. Collaborative surrealist language event. 1. For two or more people, one person writes down a question without showing it to anyone else. Simultaneously, another person writes down an answer. Poem is formed by a series of these questions and answers. Alternate form, one question, multiple answers, vice versa. For example, what is the pink elephant? The reason why it is so cold this week? Is the door locked? I have been faithful to thee, Sinara, in my fashion. Care of Robert Desnos, language events. The compositional method of Deerhead Nation, You punch a keyword or keywords or phrase into Google and work directly with the result text that gets thrown up. I paste the text into Word and just start stripping stuff away until what's left is interesting to me. Then I start meticulously chipping away at and fussing with it. Take a poem and erase all but one part of speech, leaving the visual layout intact, or read it backward, or otherwise reorder it, or translate it, using any of the translation exercises listed here. Alternatively, use these experiments as a way to rewrite or transform your own poems. Source: http://writing.upenn.edu/bernstein/experiments.html. Bernstein's many references to such figures as Tristan Tzara, 1896-1963, Robert Desnos, 1900-45, and the Surrealists, to Raymond Queneau, 1903-76, and the French literary movement known as the Oulipo, underline how Bernstein's poetics develops from Dada and subsequent models. All of these exercises subvert the notion of the single composing consciousness deploying or mastering language, and do so through the different means of randomization and chance, group composition and found materials, with the important new dimension offered by the internet. All seek in Bernstein's phrase to de-lyricize poetry and to maximize the objective as opposed to the traditional subjective orientation of poetry. It is important to recognize that the project of these forms stands against free or spontaneous writing and insists upon the potential of form. Many contemporary writers now employ some of these methods, either exclusively or as a part of their practice. As we have seen in Chapter 2, Deliberate Space, and Chapter 7, Stanza, Matthew Welton, 1969 to date, is an innovator within this tradition. His second book, published in 2009, has a title 101 words long, presented in justified type, and includes the 6 poems by themselves, mentioned in Chapter 2, where the 12 lines of each have different stanza formations, but no words, giving them a ghost-like existence. Another sequence, South Korea and Japan, he constructs from the World Cup Finals fixture list. Another series entitled 4-letter words consists of 6 poems labelled in turn Eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, coda, each made up entirely of words with 4 letters, none of them the expected ones, although vier comprised only invented words, plays teasingly close to the 4-letter cliché. Like much other work in the book, this belongs to a collaborative music piece. Perhaps the most sophisticated piece in the collection is I Must Say at First That It Was Difficult Work. The piece consists of 6 12-line stanzas in which each line is a sentence of 12 syllables. This is the first stanza. A malaise that affects the demented at first. A masseuse with a thirst for delicious liqueurs. A monsieur who's inferring that discipline hurts. A moose in wet weather is disturbed as he walks. A mosquito, a butterfly, a tickler, a worm. A mouse with white fur was sick in the water. Welton acknowledges that he is adapting a procedure from the French writer Raymond Roussel, 1877-1933, a member of the Oulipo group, who began with one sentence, chose one word from it, and then derived the next sentence by finding a word loosely homophonic to that word, and then building a subsequent sentence that in some way incorporates the new word, and so on until a whole novel, Impressions d'Afrique, was written. Welton defines this further. His first sentence, "I must say that at first it was difficult work," in fact a translation of Roussel's reported comment on writing his novel, generates a varied series of repetitions and alliterative and rhyming effects as follows. M is the second letter of the title line and of the first stanza, and in fact, of the first line of the subsequent stanza. Moreover, malaise, masseuse, monsieur, moose, mosquito, mouse are all loose homophones, and an internal rhyme associates first, thirst, hurts, disturbed, worm, fur. Indeed, only two of the whole 36 lines do not employ the sound, at least once. Through such instances as termite, burp, version, church, alert, desperate, mezuzahs, flirt, Amherst, impertinent, absurd. These do not exhaust the recurrences. The first 14 lines began with the letter A, 7 A's and 4 ands. 7 begin, I'm, 12 with the, and the last two with un. Matthew Welton writes, "The point, of course, is that in deriving one sentence from another, the outcome might be less a distortion of the original than a text with an originality of its own. And maybe, too, it is significant that this method should feel more a game of Chinese whispers than a traditional poetic use of rhyme." M. Welton. We needed coffee, but 2009, page 100. Moreover, the form in which it appears on the page in his book is not necessarily definitive. In readings, he will copy each stanza onto a different card, shuffle them before the audience, and read them in their new order, or in the one determined by audience members choosing a card. How do poems such as these get written? Matthew Welton has described his approach to me in these terms. "I was always impressed by the title of that collection of Williams interviews. I wanted to write a poem, for the way it suggests something done deliberately. And I suppose what I'm saying is that language itself is a found material, though one to which we become acclimatized. For me, it is in the poems that I make mathematically, where I try hardest to make things sound natural and avoid the angularity or disjointedness that can sometimes come in poems written through a very contrived process. And as for the physical process itself, for a long time my writing process involved saying whichever poem I was working on over and over in my head, and then, if I was happy with where I'd got it to in the course of my day, I'd write up a new draft when I got home. Pens and pencils and paper are all involved in the way I write, and as time has gone on, the paper I use has gotten bigger and bigger. I want to be able to see as many notes or drafts or versions as possible, and these days that means working with A2 sketch pads or flip chart paper or long rolls of printer's paper that unscroll across the floor of my flat as the poem progresses." Several points are particularly interesting here. First, it may be that the poems work from or with given or found materials, but that is only the spark to a clearly laborious compositional process. Second, there is this need to keep as much material as possible in view during composition, so that no possible avenue is forgotten or overlooked. Although Welton says that he also uses the computer for some aspects of poetic composition, the limits of the conventional rectangular screen, with its rigid lines in which everything but a small portion of the work in progress is invisible at any given moment, could not suit his method. A third point that emerges is the evident self-critical process. He is evidently monitoring the developing writing to make things sound natural and avoid angularity and disjointedness, striving for effects he is happy with. Even when working with the other imperatives from visual artists or composers, He writes that, "I've tried to put some poemness into what I've written. By what I think I mean, I want them to stand alone, without the images or the music." In a work like, "I must say that at first it was difficult work," this poemness is evident to me in the ancient verbal pleasure of recurrence, but also in the variety of rhythm and cadence, achieved within each reach of 12 syllables, as well as the intriguing character of the images generated. These processes have their mechanical aspects, but the poem still has to satisfy himself with any given result. And he does this intuitively. This cadence, this form of phrase or rhythm, he feels happy with. It just works. The moving text and the computer. In 2023, it is obvious that the greatest single change in the realm of communications over the preceding 40 years has been the extension of computer technology and the internet. If speed is the signature of this technology, and a hegemony over our attention is the ambition of the corporations who wield most power within it, then poetry as a slow art, which might be painstaking in its composition, one that cannot be skimmed with any profit, and is therefore domiciled in a small nook of our culture, might be thought to be alienated from it. But this is not proving to be the case in a number of respects. The first advantage lies in availability of information. The activity of poetry has virtually no access to mass publicity in any of its media. But simple internet facilities like email distribution lists enable people interested in poetry to be aware of one another, and of publications, readings, and other events and activities. Through a plethora of websites and online archives, a reader can access virtually any published poem, together with biographical and background information and criticism, some of it ongoing as other readers contribute their more or less considered thoughts on a given poet. No longer confined to hunting out the poetry section in bookshops in order not to find a poet one is looking for, the internet can nearly always furnish a book, even if it has been long out of print, and a selection of the work sought. Then, of course, specialist sites and facilities such as YouTube and Facebook provide every aspirant poet with a publishing platform, if not an audience. None of this needs labouring, but is computing and the internet altering the way poems are written today? And is this resulting in a distinctly different kind of poetry as opposed to a difference in distribution? It is probably too early to tell, but to begin an exploration of the topic, I'll return to Matthew Welton's practice. Responding to my question about the use of computer technology, Welton replied, "The poems of mine for which I first used the computer in the writing process were the ones where I set up a stencil, which repeats over and over, with different words or phrases occupying the gaps each time. More recently, I've been playing with the idea that any poem is only a version of the poem it might be, and I've been incorporating projections of rewritten versions of the poems into my readings. This takes place while I'm using effects pedals to generate new takes on the poem, as I'm saying it, and, if it's working how I want it to, leads me into making up stuff as I go along. For a lot of people working in music or the theatre or the visual arts, this might not be such drastic stuff, but I guess where poetry is concerned, there is still a lot of unexplored territory. So far, I'm having a lot of fun with it." We see here the use of a computer tool, his stencil, to facilitate the kind of structuring we have already noticed in his work. But more interesting, I think, is his idea that any poem is only a version of the poem that it might be. Our default notion of a poem is of an artifact that is carefully worked and burnished through drafts until it is fixed in print and published. Poets whose work reappears might, like W. H. Auden, 1907-73, excise poems from later editions or present new versions, but always the aim of the set, finished text, remains. For many poets, this is really the whole point, arriving exactly at what she or he wants to say with all the sensuous power that can be mustered. And the making of a book as a beautiful thing in itself is a profound personal satisfaction. But in allying two variable media, the reading and the resources of the computer, Welton is saying that the poem need not aspire to its fixity, that it can exist in differing forms, a palimpsest that can be added to, but just as importantly, readily revisit its earlier shapes. This is a potentially significant move away from what has been called codex practice, that is, the writing of poetry, or anything else, conceived to find its medium in a bound book. Digital computing clearly offers opportunities for poetry to move away from its traditional medium. Its direction was, in fact, already pointed by W. H. Auden in the film Poems he made with John Grierson and the GPO film unit until the 1930s. The most well-known of these is Night Mail, a documentary about an express mail train journeying overnight to Scotland, for which Auden wrote a rhyming verse commentary timed to the edited film with the use of a stopwatch. His poem therefore becomes synchronized with the visual imagery, and, through the verse meter, with the soundtrack of the train's movement over the rails. But the most extensive work done in this field is that of Tony Harrison, 1937 to date, who has devised, written, and sometimes directed several poem films for British television through the 1980s and 1990s. All are published as texts, sometimes like V, 1985, to photographs or stills. But the essential life of these poems is in the synthesis of the voiced word and image. It may seem paradoxical that Harrison's verse works exclusively in strong meter and rhyme, albeit in a highly colloquial and contemporary manner. And yet he is one of the most forward-looking and formally ambitious of contemporary poets for the medium of poetry. His register is dramatic, not primarily lyrical. The Gaze of the Gorgon, for instance, which takes as its subject the wide sweep of 20th century warfare, is cast in the voice of the German poet Heinrich Heine, 1797-1856, and V. is a scabrous dialogue between the poet and the teenage vandal who is intent on the spray-painted desecration of the local graveyard.
"Listen, cunt," I said, "before you start your jeering, the reason I wanted this in a book is to give ungrateful cunts like you a hearing. A book, your stupid cunts, not verse a fuck."
In Harrison's work, not only the medium of the book, but its politics is always in play. Born Digital. What of poems that are conceived and composed in the digital format? What difference is achieved by virtue of the medium itself? This is difficult to discuss in this context, since it is impossible to represent or quote here. One digital poet and theorist, Stephanie Strickland, 1942, insists that if a digital poem could be printed out, it isn't e-lit. One such work Strickland admires is The Dream Life of Letters by Brian Kim Steffens, 1969 to date. http://collection.eliterature.org https://1/works/Stephens_the_dreamlife_of_letters.html. According to its author, this attempts to explore the ground between classic concrete poetry, avant-garde feminist practice, and ambient poetics. That's really just plain fun to watch. Stephens takes a text by another author, alphabetizes its component words, and runs them in a sequence which choreographs them in swift, elegant patterns against an orange ground. At times, the effect is rather like the Busby Berkeley dance choruses filmed from above, in which the dancers become folding and unfolding abstract shapes. It is really, as Stephens acknowledges, an antique concrete poem as video art. Like concrete poetry, discussed in Chapter 3, Deliberate Space, it concentrates upon the aesthetics of letters and words to produce a textscape independent of conventional semantics. One wonders what the emblem poets of the 17th century, like George Herbert, or the Dadaist, Hugo Ball, might have made of these resources. The technology is deeply attractive to digital practitioners, rather like the futurist artists of the early 20th century. They exult in the capacities of machines to automate writing, or rather, the generation of text. As Christian Bock, 1966, writes, "Why hire a poet to write a poem when the poem can in fact write itself?" Like their acknowledged antecedents, the Dadaists, in some respects the Surrealists, the concrete poets and Oulipo, the practitioners and theorists of digital poetics, challenge traditional ideas of the autonomy of the creative mind by pointing to the influence of the invisible or assumed determinations of genre, style and tradition on poetic composition. As Italo Calvino wrote, "An author is already a writing machine. Hence, as we have noted, the acceptance of constraint-based techniques, such as those of Roussel and Welton. Philosophically, the contention is that true freedom lies in inventing and respecting absurd rules. Artificial intelligence can, of course, write poems, although their validity is a philosophical question to be addressed in the near future." Matthew Welton, on being asked to update the account of his practice over the nearly 10 years since the previous edition of this book, finds himself surprised by the changes he has made. One of these has been the loss of interest in using a computer, and indeed in tightly mathematical approaches to writing. He has written a series of poems entitled Construction with Phrases, Construction with Stencil, and Construction on Six Principles, which, as the titles imply, work on very set templates. In fact, six sections of 12 lines divided into three stanzas, with each line made of 12 syllables and the meter iambic throughout. Achieved without a computer, Welton nonetheless writes that he has lost his curiosity in making poems with such relentless tessellation. What has interested him more, as in his book, Squid Squad, A Novel, 2020, was putting some elements of fiction, such as character or action, into poems, and also to balance imagery and abstraction. He quotes, "The eloquence of melody outweighs the melody of eloquence," murmurs Dustin Mostyn as he measures out the milk. Audrey Chaudhry skips over the tripwire. "The wasps come like whims," says Ruth Wraith. More recently, he says, he has sought to write short, standalone poems, things you might call lyric poems, I suppose, as opposed to the large calculated structures of "We Wanted Coffee," but this sounds to be a long way from AI, but progress in poetry is a constant surprise. another medium which the digital scroll resembles, or potentially resembles, is of course the oral tradition, which, as we have seen in Chapter 2, has always enabled fluidity, variation, and improvisation. So the changes that may be offered by digital media are well summarized in this statement from Loz Pequeno Glazier of the Electronic Poetry Center in sunny Buffalo. Writing is not a single, monumental totality that can be measured. Rather, what can be charted is writing as an overlapping hybrid and extendable terrain of parts of writing, parts that fit together at times awkwardly and out of joint, to compose a textual continuum through which writing practices weave. https://epc.buffalo.edu/authors/glazier/dp/intro1.html. These practices need not be individually authored. The technology readily enables participation. On the model of the blog, and so collaborative composition online becomes an easy and developing possibility. Put this together with the improvisational elements in performance poetry and a different, more freewheeling and flexible aesthetic emerges. Moreover, the possibilities of multimedia begin to combine voice, word, image, and music, extend the character of poetry yet further. Conclusion. As Gertrude Stein says, at any given time we can only guess at what is truly contemporary and will change in the future. As this brief account indicates, writing poetry now includes several different practices, some overlapping, some quite distinct. Poems are written for the page and book. They are written to be performed. They are written with machines. They are written to be disseminated by the various means of the web. They are written in and for university classes and many other kinds of groups. These poems may continue to exploit the traditional modes of meter, rhyme, and stanza, especially when composed for performance. Or they may be exploring the freedoms in sound and visual space opened by the 20th century's free verse revolution. This range of possibility in contemporary poetry, for both writers and readers, is now more accessible than at any time in history. In comparison with cinema or popular music, the reach of poetry remains, and is likely to remain, small. Nonetheless, the modern extension of literary education in schools and colleges has slowly enlarged that minority, and two quite recent developments can further that growth. First, the capacity of information technology, as I have indicated, makes the pursuit of an interest in poetry easier than ever before. The ability it gives to satisfy some nagging curiosity about John Skelton, circa 1460 to 1529, and then at another hour or day to read more of a present-day poet whose verse has caught our attention, means that as readers we can create our own fluid anthologies. The second development is the growth of creative writing in all parts of the English curriculum. Its best practice is always, I believe, in concert with reading, and its principal project is not the nurture of genius. Rather, it works to add an expressive field to study to enable students to discover the possibilities and the difficulties of working in language, and to understand the process and nature of literary texts by means other than the reverse engineering of analysis and criticism. Moreover, the staple presence of the workshop in creative writing practice offers the experience and contribution of other minds as a measure for the writer's own interior sense. Neither of these changes is of interest only to former students of English. For some, poetry might be a new discovery later in life, or one revived when the demands for qualifications are passed. Whether pursued with intensity or sporadic interest, the endlessly extending library of poetry awaits, and the traditional tools of its practice, voice and pen, which have always been comparatively accessible, are now complemented by a two-way medium of the internet. If it is too much to say, then the long-held ideal in art to break down the wall between producer and passive consumer has been achieved in the reading and writing of poetry now, then there is perhaps no other artistic practice where that wall is more permeable. Summary. In this chapter, we have looked at the traditional issues facing a practicing poet, along with some testimony from contemporary poets about their different practices, the experience of intuition in composition, the creative pressure of set forms, the role of set exercises in composition, translation and its influence, the challenge to conventional expressive practice by the random and template generation of poetic texts, digital poetics, and the influence of the internet, the place of creative writing in the contemporary sphere of poetry.